Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, we're going to start this morning with some live music. With me here in our studio is young singer-songwriter Claire O'Riordan, who hails from Middleton in Cork, originally Wilton. She released her second album, Outside, earlier this year, and it was produced by Tori Amos's bass player. Later on, we're going to have a chat, Claire, but you're going to start off this morning and sing live for us your own composition, Sailor.
Thundering heart, raging mind, born in blood of honesty's child, gives birth to the world anew. When it's dark, you pull us through. The thundering heart, raging mind, born in blood of honesty's child, gives birth to the world anew. When it's dark, pull us through, sailor of hope and dreams, still sweet after bitter years, speaks words we long to hear, lover of truth, dream free, la la la. No bounds, he finds essence behind the shroud. Black days turn blue, seeking light we draw to you. This wandering spirit knows no bounds, he finds essence behind the shroud. Black days turn blue, seeking light we draw to you. After bitter years, speaks words we long to hear, lover of truth, dream free, sailor of hope and dreams, so sweet after bitter years.
Claire, thank you so much for that. It was beautiful. That's your own composition, Sailor. You're going to go off and come back later on in the show and we'll have a chat. Thanks so much. Meanwhile, here in studio, I'm sitting in front of three people. As many of you know, every year in Ireland, 4,000 people develop some form of dementia. And the number with dementia is set to double over the next 20 years. Many have experienced a friend or a family member who has the condition. And joining me this morning is Jacinta Dixon, who herself was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2016. And she's now a member of the Irish Dementia Working Group, which is supported by the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. And along with Jacinta this morning is Áine Ryan, who's documented so vividly in her writings in the Irish Times about her father, who is currently living with dementia, and also writer Ian Mullaney, whose grandfather John Joe lived with Alzheimer's for 5 years until his death in 2016. And Ian, your new book of essays, Minor Monuments, weaves in beautifully the stories of your granddad as your family coped with his condition. Good morning to you all. Thanks so much for coming in this morning. And it's not going to be a depressing conversation, because I know for people listening this Sunday morning, they might worry about that. Jacinta, let me start with you. When were you first diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
I was officially diagnosed about, I would say, 3 years, 2.5 to 3 years ago. But in retrospect, it was clear that I'd had some sort of issues before that, which were difficult at the time, but I didn't really realise what they were.
Let's go right back. Tell me about yourself. Where you lived, where you're from, what you worked at, about your family. Tell me a bit about Jacinta.
Well, Jacinta was born and bred in the middle of the city, right by City Hall.
Here in Dublin.
In Dublin.
Great.
In Dublin, yeah. And lived there for until I was virtually married, really. And I spent a lot of time out of Ireland after I married. We lived in Kenya and Tanzania for a long time, and spent a lot of time there. Then came back to Ireland, and I studied a little bit. And I have my children in East Africa as well. I had three children, two boys and a girl, Sarah. And that's my background.
Great.
I suppose. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when did you first notice there was something wrong? I mean, a lot of people worry, don't they, Jacinta, because they think, oh, geez, I can't remember something, or I can't remember where I left my keys. But that's kind of quite normal. When did you think there was actually something wrong with your memory?
Well, I did. That's exactly what I thought at the beginning. I thought, oh, it's just aging process. And but I had been working in the disability sector for quite some time. And I know my work was not good. My employers did comment on it. And so eventually I just left work and decided to retire earlier. Then after a little while, maybe a year or two, I knew there was something wrong, spoke to my daughter. And she managed, we managed to get services provided to us in Beaumont Hospital, which is the area I was living in. And they did an absolutely amazingly thorough process with me to try and find out what was going on. And of course, the diagnosis was that I had dementia initially, and then they added the Alzheimer's end of it onto me. So, yeah.
Can you remember that moment, Jacinta, when you were told you had dementia? In other words, how did you deal with that? And can you remember when you were told?
I can remember vividly, because I remember I was sitting down on a chair, and I had all these doctors around me and nurses in my own home, and they were sort of over there talking, and I was over here saying I now officially have dementia. Mm. And but you know, I'd known.
Yeah.
I'd known, you know, you know there's something wrong.
Yeah.
So I'd known. So it was a kind of a get on with it.
And how long ago was that?
About 2.5 to 3 years. I'm not sure exactly, but around that time, 2.5 to 3 years. Yeah.
But I'm talking to you now, and I was talking to you earlier before we went on air, and you seem pretty good today.
I don't like, that's what they say.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. People say, yeah. And I suppose I'm fortunate in that I still have a bit of a head on me, you know. And
you have than a bit of a head.
It's not as straightforward as that. I suppose I'm used to talking about this sort of stuff. And so it's not as... there are so many little quirks that are from the minute you get up right to even before you get up, you know, there are things you have to be careful about and watch about, and it's a bit of a, you know, it can be a struggle, but I have huge support. I really do. I have my family is incredibly supportive. And I moved from my own home to be close to them. Two of my children live in Clondalkin, where I've moved to now, and my sister, who lives in Donamead area. I can't get the right name out there. Hurst Mary, she's been just brilliant. And my sister in the States, who keeps tabs on me as well and stuff. So I have the support there, and that is
key.
It's key.
Anya Ryan, you want to come there. And just for my listener, Anya, of course, you're a freelance journalist for the Mayo News. And you write the Daddy Dementia Me column in the Irish Times, which is so powerful, about your own dad. You wanted to come in there, Anya, as well.
Well, yes. I'm just wondering, just to kind of put it in some concrete terms, for example, because of my experience with George.
Who's your dad?
Yes, yeah. With George, George Ryan. Could you get the bus into town and remember, you know, where to come back home to still? If you don't mind me asking,
yes.
That sounds superficial.
No,
but George
couldn't
do that in the end.
Yes, I can. I mean, I was brought born and bred in the city anyway, so that helps a little bit. I do. I go to town.
If you're in another city?
I'm not so sure about that.
Okay.
There was a time when I would have said yes, but I'm not so sure now, because even when I go into town now, there are times when I would stand there for a minute and say, oh, where am I? It's momentary, but it's there. So going to another city, I would have to probably continue to ask people. And not everybody is willing to ask somebody once, not where to go, but to read a magazine for me, because I can't read or write anymore. And the lady turned around and said, are you illiterate? So you're never quite sure what sort of response you're going to get.
I'm really surprised about that, that you can't read or write anymore.
Those skills have gone. I can't tell you exactly what it is, but my daughter knows exactly why I can't. But I could try and write my letter, my name, but I would not be able to read it back, and the people I read to probably wouldn't be able to.
What I find is it's so complex. We'll say George, my father is 88 now. And
he's still alive, isn't he?
He's still alive. His life was becoming increasingly unmanageable in about 2012, but he had no idea. He happened to be living in an apartment in Inchicore, and, you know, his main interest in life was he was still writing his Irish Times, reporting on the bridge, which was interesting because
he was a former school teacher.
He was a former school teacher, retired early, yes. A rapscallion and a rebel about everything from day one.
Great.
And the really interesting thing, if I may diverge there, is that while I see it as, you know, the threads of memory are, you know, for him, they're like in a huge big tapestry, but they're disconnected. But he is happily living in separate moments. It's kind of like he could give a course on mindfulness, because you walk into his room in the nursing home in Westport and you could have just walked out a minute ago. Do you know, he never looks surprised to see you. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
He's stuck in the moment. But just to go back to his situation at the beginning, he was living in Inchicore for maybe 30 years or something like that. And we began, you know, he rebelled against everything because he would say he hadn't. One of his things was, my short-term memory may not be that great, but I haven't lost my powers of reasoning, you know, as he was about to attack you for daring to, do you know what I mean? Say,
yeah.
Daddy, blah. Mm-hmm. But we were bringing him to various appointments in James's along by the Lewis. And one of the first days that it really struck me was we got off the Lewis and we were walking down Tyrconnell Road, which he had lived on, and we went in. He was dying to go to the loo, or he wanted a coffee. He's quite demanding, you know, and we had to do it there and then. We went in and we walked out and he looked around and he said, where the hell are we, Anya? Mm. And, you know, but the receivers or the family don't accept things straight away either. He wasn't accepting it, but we weren't either, I suppose.
And Ian, of course, you wrote this great book recently, and tell us about your own grandfather. He's no longer with us, but John Joe, is that his name?
Yeah, John Joe. So he lived in Offaly his whole life, West Offaly, kind of quite near the Shannon, I suppose. And I grew up next door. Quite a remote little area. There was not too many houses around, so he was very much in his place for his whole life. a big part of the community, a local farmer, a small farmer, and just, yeah, a real presence on the roads everywhere, and everyone knew him, and there was only one John Joe is what the priest said at his funeral, so everyone was very familiar with him. He was a big character. For us growing up, he was huge. You know, he was such a fun granddad to have. Like, he'd bring us around in the Jeep and bring us for sweets after Mass on Sundays and all these kinds of things. So a real sweet man. And yeah, for I guess the last 5 or 6 years of his life, probably we were aware that dementia had kind of come into his life in some way and was gradually changing him and changing the way that he related to.
And you've written your new book of essays, Minor Monuments, kind of weaving stories of your granddad as your family coped with his condition. Because in the end, what impact did it have on, I suppose, you and your wider family?
I think it was a huge impact. I think, you know, for all of us, probably John Joe was the father figure, you know, the patriarchal figure of the family, really. You know, he could tell anyone to do something and they'd probably just go and do it. And for that to change, I think for his kids particularly, for my dad and his siblings, you know, to enter into a state of kind of watchfulness and care for someone like this who had been so independent and so self-driven his whole life, I think that was a huge change for them to have to, yeah, sit him down and tell him not to do certain things, or that he couldn't drive anymore was a huge one. That was a massive one. So there are these moments where people have to step in, and I think those were often difficult moments for my dad and his sister particularly.
I loved in the book as well that you wrote about the bogs and Bora, how your connection one day, you were left minding him, weren't you, in small talk, explaining that and how you ended up, he called you Bora.
Yeah, he called me Bora. So I work as a journalist and I have been down in Bora, in Loch Bora, which is a kind of touristy spot in Offaly, one of the very few touristy spots in Offaly. And I've been doing a piece about the area, and I told him this, and he worked for Borna Mona for quite a long time, and Borna Mona have a sort of operation there in Bora. And yeah, when Nana would go to Mass on Saturday evenings, we would be left alone and we would chat away for an hour or two, and we'd talk about the weather or whatever. And he got into his head basically that I was working in Bora for Borna Mona. And I didn't correct him. There was no point correcting him at this point. There was no point. So I just went along with it and pretended like I knew what I was talking about and not having a clue, really. And yeah, for a few months at least, not knowing my name, really, or even recognising me a lot of the time, that became the association. So I'd walk in and I'd be Bora.
Yeah.
So he never worked in Bora.
No.
He just thought he did. So he worked in a different bog. But... Mm-hmm.
But it was a real connection, in a sense, at that moment, he felt, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, I think a lot has changed in the space of 2 generations in that area. We live very different lives. And so to have that kind of moment where, even if it's a little bit of a lie or whatever, to imagine that we're quite similar and we have that in common, that was very meaningful, I think.
Yeah, it was lovely. Your dad, by the way, Owen, is a bit of a character. He got expelled from his first.
Yes.
Tell me why.
Well, yes, he was in at Christmas 2014. He was ended up in James's with heart failure, and was rebellious. He had to have a one-to-one minder in James's. He escaped so often and did all sorts of stuff and used the Constitution, you know, for his smoking habits and the men of 1916, and said, "Was this what they died for, to stop us smoking on the grounds of
good
James?"
Man.
James's Hospital. But anyway, he went to a Dublin nursing home and he escaped. He managed, and this is how complex memory is, he managed to learn off the code to get out. Do you know? And yeah, so he escaped a few times. He smoked in places where he wasn't allowed. And they were pretty smart. Within the contract time, I'd say he was probably the first and last person that's ever been expelled from the place, we managed to luckily find a place that was more conducive to his smoking needs, and I think this is really interesting, talking about the car. The keys of the car were very central to George, even 3 years after his car was sold, George was still looking for his car. Mm. And one day I went on a mad drive looking for a car that was no longer out there. Crazy.
With it, him?
Yes. Yeah. And the keys of the car, and for him, smoking. And for ladies in the nursing home, it's their handbags with everything in them. Because every little bit of, and obviously it's great you're living independently, and my experience is looking at people in nursing homes, which is another whole kind of discussion about our society, you know, because they are incarcerated and locked in those nursing homes. But, you know, I really empathise when you said about the car, the Jeep being taken from your granddad. Mm. You know, it's his last bit of independence. He can never go anywhere, make his mind up to go anywhere on his own again.
Yeah. And it's one thing in Inchicore, but in a remote corner of Offaly, you really you're about 4 miles from the nearest town, so you really aren't going anywhere without a Jeep. So.
Yeah, that's right. But George had no ability to reflect on how dangerous he would have been out on the road as well.
Of course, no.
You know, that's the other thing. But he was always like that. He wasn't reflective about his inadequacies.
And as you write on your column about your dad, George, I thought there were two very moving comes. One was about your brother.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, my youngest brother, Dermot, who I was very close to, and George is very, very close to. I'm the eldest, he was the youngest. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in January 2017. He was a clinical psychologist, commuted between Dublin and Italy because his wife lives in Italy and his sons, and he was dead by May.
In his 40s?
Yes, 48. Never drank, didn't smoke, ran every second day. It was just horrific. And Daddy lives in the moment, right? So when you go into when you go in, you're just in that little bubble with him, and he never, rarely, okay, he'll have sequence of questions he asks you. So he might spend a whole visit saying, how are your daughters on you? Tell me what they're doing now. Are they married yet? You know, or it might be something else. But he never, ever, since he went into the nursing home, even though he was close to Dermot, he never mentioned him. That's just the way. He never mentioned any of our siblings. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And a couple of months after Daddy died,
After your brother Dermot died.
Or sorry, yes, after no, Dermot that's fine, died. Yeah. Sorry, after Dermot died. Sorry, it's just so.
No, it was. Of
course. He, out of the blue one day, he said, how is Dermot on you? He hasn't been in to see me for a while. You tell him to come in and see me. And I froze. My heart stopped. I wrote about it. And it's the only time, you know, I just said, I will, Daddy. Because I didn't know what impact. And to this day, we've never told him. We've never told him now. His ex-wife, our mother, died last year, but she was ill for a long time with dementia as well. And I do tell him that because he was at a remove from her for a long time. Mm. But we've never told him about Dermot. But it was one of the most traumatic visits I had with him, to be honest.
Horrendous. Yeah. But actually, another nice column you did is you took your mum and dad, although they've been separated for decades, out together.
Myself and my sister Breda, it was so daft.
They both had Alzheimer's, didn't they?
They both, yeah. Mammy was in another nursing home. They were still living independently then. And Breda, my sister, who lives in Dublin, and I decided they didn't like each other at all. They really did not like each other. They were separated for a long time for good reason, you know? And so we decided we'd bring them out for a drive. And so we went over. Mammy was in the front of the car, tiny little butterfly, wizened butterfly at that stage, you know, could barely speak. She'd Parkinson's as well. And George gets in, you know, and chats her up for the whole kind of journey over to Fairview and talks about, and your hair is lovely.
Because he'd no idea who she was.
Well, I'm not sure about, he probably had an idea who she was. The kind of irony was, so we go along Fairview promenade and we take pictures and all that kind of stuff. And she's very silent because her voice is was gone from the Parkinson's. And so she was just a quiet, gentle person. But anyway, at the very end, when he got out and they said goodbye, and, you know, he asked her all sorts of questions, everything. She turned around to Breda, she was in the front of the car, and she said, who was that nice man?
Yeah.
I just thought, they had 6 children together, you know. It's kind of, that was quite ironic as well.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting.
Yeah.
But Jacinta, although you now live with Alzheimer's, and I was chatting to you earlier, you stay very positive, don't you?
there isn't any other option. Mm-hmm. You know, I still just try and be as normal as I possibly can. I mean, there are a huge number of things I can't do anymore. Reading, writing, audiobooks and stuff. I can't even operate with those. So there's a lot of things gone out of my life, which sometimes, you know, on a bad day, I get really, really frustrated and poor me-ish, you know.
Yeah.
And I hibernate for a day or two and then I get up and get out and start running again, you know. So, you know, it's difficult, but you've got actually no choice. It's sit like this for the rest of your life, and who knows, you know, I could go on for quite a long time, hopefully. But you just have to keep going. And I think my message would be to people with Alzheimer's, or to their families, I suppose, more so, is to support them to keep as active as possible for as long, because there's so much you can do, and society is beginning to open up to that now. They're opening up and they're seeing these things. There are most of the museums and galleries have got programs for people with some sort of a disability, and there's lots of stuff out there. But they need support to get to those places. So to keep family and friends in the loop as much as you can, and just to try and get this support, you know, provide that support. And for small communities, I mean, I live in quite a small community in Dublin and in Clondalkin. And, you know, those small communities would be really, really good places for a start, for people to just see somebody, go see somebody, see if they need any, if you can just give them even 5 minutes of your time. It's brilliant, you know.
Well, our listeners, Gary tweeted to pay tribute to you, Jacinta, your guest this morning. She says she's such a brave woman to speak about her experiences. And David Whelan says we really need to explore new options and models. This is what you were saying, Áine, of care for people with dementia. Nursing homes are not the answer for all or even any. Ian, your book, Minor Monuments, is published by Tram Press.
Yep.
I recommend everyone to read it. It's a lovely book. Áine Ryan, you're keeping up your diary in the Irish Times about your dad, George.
Yes, there's another one in a couple of weeks, yes.
It's wonderful. And Jacinta, of course, Dixon. And just to say, the Alzheimer's Tea Day,
yes,
talking to Cormac there for the society, is on May the 2nd, 2019. It's a massive fundraiser for Alzheimer's.
It's huge. If I could just very briefly say that we really expected some funding from we were given to believe that there was going to be some funding from the state at last year's budget, and we got absolutely zilch. We can't continue with the work that we do in Alzheimer's society if we don't get funding. We just can't do it, and it's so important. So we really encourage people to get involved in that Alzheimer's Tea Day.
Well, Jacinta, you're a wonderful advocate yourself for your own Alzheimer's, and I hope I'll be speaking to you again just like this in a good few years' time. So keep healthy, keep strong. Thank to all of you for coming in this morning. More reaction there to our discussion on Alzheimer's. Jacinta Dixon, of course, who has Alzheimer's, was just talking to us. One of our listeners says, what a wonderful lady Jacinta is. And another, Pat McLaughlin, who's CEO of the Alzheimer's Society, says, many thanks for covering the issue of Alzheimer's and highlighting the scale of the challenge. No problem at all for that, Pat. Well, I'm rejoined in our studio by the great singer-songwriter who hails all the way from Cork, Claire O'Riordan. Thanks for coming back, Claire.
Thank you.
Sang a beautiful song for us earlier, Sailor, which is from your new album called Outside, isn't it?
Yes, it's track number 10. I wrote the song about a guy called Rodriguez. He was a singer-songwriter. And he was in there's this brilliant film documentary that was made called Searching for Sugar Man. And it tells a story. He was famous in South Africa, but he didn't even know about it. And in America, his music was a flop. And anyway, his music, I think, inspired a lot of people during the time of apartheid. And he was a real light. And I watched the documentary, at least I have watched it actually at least five times. And I felt a really strong desire to write a song about him. And it was like the next day anyway, I went into my piano and I started writing lyrics, and I didn't even know what I was writing about. I just, these words were coming into my head. And then I was halfway through the song and I was like, oh my God, I'm writing about Rodriguez. This is great. Awesome. Yeah.
And you have a beautiful soul voice. Your new album as well was produced by Tori Amos's bass player. How did that come about?
So my sister lives in Cape Cod, and she had heard about this guy. She knows a lot of musicians over there. So I just got in contact with him and sent him music from my first album. He loved it and said he was very happy to work with me. And the album itself was actually recorded over 10 days. And I made 3 trips over to do that. And I got to hang out with my sister as well, which was great.
Which is great. And you have lots of good gigs coming up. You've got one in Ballydehob on Saturday the 11th of May. That's at Leaves It Says. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then the Doolin Folk Festival on June the 15th. Yes. And you're going to the States, aren't you? You have another
gig. That's right. I'm going to be doing, I'm actually headlining a festival called Belonging to Each Other. And that's on the September the 13th in Cape Cod. So looking forward to that.
That would be great. And of course, your website, Claire, is claireoreardon.com. So you're going to sing another song for us now. What are you going to sing?
I'm going to do a cover of Forever Young by Bob Dylan.
Brilliant. So you go over and get yourself ready, Claire, because you're singing live for us. I'm always amazed by people who sing this early live on radio. Lovely text here about you from Jimmy Stafford. What a lovely woman Clara Reardon is. Such a hard worker in the music industry. Another Kevin Long says, Miriam, great to hear the wonderfully talented Clara Reardon on the show this morning. Her new album Outside is amazing. So in your own time, Clara Reardon, thanks so much for coming in today.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. And may you always do for others and let others do for you. And may you build a ladder to the stars, climb on every rung, and may you stay forever young. May you have a strong foundation when the winds of changes shift. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung. And may you stay forever young. Forever young.
We've had lots and lots of reaction to our interviews about Alzheimer's. Orla says, Miriam, these stories are heartbreakingly honest, real and so informative. I can only add there, but for the grace of God, go we. Another says, fascinating listening to such an honest interview with Jacinta Dixon about living with dementia. People with dementia need support and need to be included in the community. Another says, what a wonderful lady Jacinta is. She's an inspiration. I feel at times I'm getting it, but I'm afraid to find out. As for George's daughter, it brings me back to memories with my aunt who had it. Thanks for the interviews. Hopefully it will help. And another says, Miriam, there's so much ignorance, stigma and lack of knowledge about dementia in general. Best wishes to Jacinta. One from Mayo, then I'll take one more because there are a lot. I work for Community Action on Dementia in Mayo. We provide support and care and currently have 4 dance music memory social clubs running across the county. Please would you just give our number out? Sure, no problem. It's 086-836-6312. They're just dance music memory social evenings for anyone with dementia. Well, I'm now joined in the studio by 2 very special people. When a loved one dies abroad, a tragedy can often turn quickly into a logistical nightmare of bureaucracy, navigating foreign procedures and spiralling costs. However, the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust, which was set up by Ethna and Colin Bell after the death of their beloved son Kevin when he was only 26 and abroad, has been helping Irish people financially, emotionally and practically to bring home the bodies of their loved ones from as far afield as Australia, Thailand, the US and many more. I'm so delighted you're both here, Colin and Ethna. I've heard about you for years, but just, you know, in the past few weeks myself, I've heard of people constantly saying how good you are to them. So well done to you both. Listen, go back if you don't mind, Ethna. Tell me about your own. Tell me first of all about Kevin, what kind of a fella he was.
Kevin was full of fun, full of life. He worked all hours, God sent, to be able to get enough money to go and travel somewhere else. And he'd been in Australia for a while. And then whenever he went to New York, he may as well have been employed by the tourist board for New York because all his friends come over, had to see all the sights. He was just, he would ring us every week. He would ring my mummy and daddy, who were elderly, and Colin's mother too. He was just a great boy as far as family was concerned, but and a great friend, so many.
And Colin, to remind my listeners who might not know, tell me what happened to your Kevin.
Kevin had gone out on the Saturday night, as he would normally do, maybe Tuesday night, Wednesday night as well. He enjoyed himself.
Good.
And he came home and got out of a taxi outside his apartment in Woodlawn. And unfortunately, a speeding white van, kind of out of control, hit him and knocked him onto the road, where he was hit by another vehicle and both vehicles drove on. But fortunately enough, he was killed instantly and wouldn't have known anything about it, thank God.
Yeah, thank God. And how did you hear, Ethna?
Kevin had gone out, and a friend of his, Shamie, had contacted his mummy and daddy, who just lived down the road from us. And it had actually been Colin's 60th birthday on the 15th of June. And we were all in the house together. We were getting ready for a family party on the 16th. And they came at 11 o'clock in the morning, just knocked the door, and I answered the door and said, what's happened, Kevin? And because as soon as I saw them, I knew there was something. And I said, how bad is it? And Vinnie just said, it's the worst. So, and just called Colin and the rest of the children.
I'm so sorry, but out of that, it was your experience, wasn't it, Colin, then, of just getting him home? It made you realise that, you know...
Actually, no.
Okay.
Because Ethna's cousin, Nasa Negonal, lived in Manhattan. And Kevin had been with the Armagh Gaelic team out in New York. So between the two, they went on Kevin's... Postmortem took place on the Sunday afternoon. They went first thing Monday morning. Wouldn't take no for an answer from anybody. If they were told to call back at 4:30, said no, there's a family waiting at home. And unbelievably, Kevin was killed on Sunday morning, and he was on the plane on Tuesday night, and he was home on Wednesday morning into the house.
Oh, that is wonderful.
So it was totally amazing, but totally down to NASA and the Armagh Gaelic team. But the funny thing is, well, not the funny thing, but we would have done anything to get Kevin home. It was so important to get him home. And, of course, once Ethna heard the news, I mean, she couldn't rest. She was up to high dough. And the minute that Kevin's coffin came into the house, there was a calmness came with it. And that showed to me, you know, how important it is, especially for Irish people, to get their loved ones home.
So out of your great tragedy, why and when did you decide to set up this repatriation trust?
Well, there was fantastic fundraising done in the town of Newry. Newry people, unbelievable, so generous.
It was like the town of Newry just put their arms around us, like it was like a blanket around us. And on the Tuesday night, there was a table quiz organised by Edna O'Rourke in the Canal Court Hotel, and there was £42,000 raised. On the Thursday night,
incredible,
there was a fun run and walk. There was £20,000 raised, and the people in Newry just couldn't do enough. Bagpacks, big breakfasts, anything that anybody could do, and in total, there was about £150,000 raised to bring Kevin home. And of course, it didn't take that much. So I suppose that was the start of it. About a couple of weeks after Kevin's funeral, we heard of a young fellow from Kerry Duff in Belfast had been killed in Thailand. So we contacted the parents and said, look, we have this money, we'll pay to bring your son home. A couple of weeks after that, a young fellow from Sligo, Conor Brady, was killed in, or died in Las Vegas. Again, we reached out to the family. And, you know, once it arrives at your own door, you notice it. You probably wouldn't have noticed how many Irish people were dying abroad, but once it comes to your own door, you notice. So we kept reaching out, and then we said, look, we'll make this Kevin's legacy, and we applied to become a charity, and eventually became a charity. And I suppose over this weekend now, it's unfortunately we'll be passing the 700 mark.
So you know? Never think of the number of people who died.
This year alone, isn't it? About 70 this year alone taken home. And we're only, in April?
And you don't get state funding for this, sure you don't?
No, and to be honest, I mean, it says so much for Irish community. We don't need funding from the government, because even today, I know there are three or four fundraisers going on somewhere in Ireland for us.
It's nearly self-generating.
Yeah.
Because the different families, now they aren't compelled to do it, but they feel, most families feel as though they want to do some type of fundraiser to keep their loved one's memory alive. And it's just unbelievable. I think it's whenever you're in that situation, you understand how other people feel. And they're all helping the next families that are going to get the news. And really, whenever you think 70 this year already, it's unbelievable.
That actually is incredible. I mean, how much does it cost? A lot of money. It's obviously something you never think about, unless, as you say, it comes to your own door, Colin. I mean, you often think, would travel insurance not cover it? No. Yeah, I mean, that's, people think that, don't they?
Yeah, but I hope that people do take their travel insurance. You know, it's so important for people to be insured, and we're not, we don't want to be a safety net when people say, look, because I mean, so many other things can happen when you're on holiday or you're abroad. If you take ill and you need hospital and stuff like that, there. So I mean, I would say everybody, you know, if you're going abroad, take out insurance. But we're very lucky in that we get so much support. And you were asking there about, you know, costs. Well, I mean, we take quite a few people home from England. It's generally between 1,000 and 2,000. From Europe, it could be, if we're talking euro now, I suppose, we're talking maybe between 4 and 6 thousand euro. If you go to Thailand, you're up to 7-8 thousand. If you go to Australia, it could be around 8,000. America is quite expensive. It's generally between 8,000 and 10,000. With 700, I mean, we have a network now of experience, and if a family contacts us, then we can say, look, you don't have to do another thing. We'll look after everything, and then we'll pay for it as well.
It's just such a wonderful charity. It really is. Is the repatriation of someone who dies abroad, is it complicated? And does it vary from country and country? And do all countries and airlines treat all bodies with the same level of respect? I know that sounds a strange question, but I'm just wondering.
No, it's not really. It's not as complicated as people think. But when it comes to your door, you've no experience, and you say, what do we do? Who do we contact? Mm. How do we go about it? And generally, we've taken that many home in the space of a fortnight. At the end of 2016, we took 8 young people home from Perth in Australia in the space of a fortnight, who all died with unrelated. Our two young lads were killed together when a slab fell on them. But there were, you know, a young fella committed suicide, a young girl went into organ failure, a young fella fell off scaffolding, a young fella was killed, and but because one phone call now to Perth, we'll get it done. One phone call to New York, we'll get it done. One phone call to Sydney, you know, because
you know all the process.
Yes, and
I'm just thinking that we began by talking about your Kevin and how obviously it's still so upsetting, but you're constantly being contacted by families who must be so upset at that moment they contact you. Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Well, as I say, the big thing is to say, look, you don't have to do anything else. We will take care of it, and we'll keep you informed, and we'll try and get your loved one home as quickly as possible. And you know, I mean, it's an honour to be able to help families at that time.
But it's so remarkable. I mean, you suffered this great tragedy, the death of Kevin, but you've given it all back in spades by setting this up. Has it, having the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust, has it helped you deal with your own loss and grief?
I think most definitely it has. And then, like 8 months after Kevin was killed, my sister's son, Paul, was killed in San Francisco. Same circumstances, hit and run. And it's, you know, whenever it comes knocking at the door, it's, you meet fantastic people and you see people in their raw state. You understand what they're going through. There's no pretense with people. You know, some people will try and put on this different cloak and be some people that they aren't. But whenever tragedy like this hits you and you meet other families who have gone through the same thing, you just see people as they are. A true person.
Oh, look, you're a remarkable couple. I'm sorry you lost your beautiful son, Kevin. I'm going to read you one text just as I have time for. My sister died abroad about 20 years ago. It took a month because of autopsy, etc., and we buried her a month and a half later. It prolongs the suffering and you are in limbo. I am so grateful to the Kevin Bell Trust for easing the process for others. It's a tribute to Kevin and his family's kindness. I couldn't say it better myself. Colin Nathan-Bell, thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming down this morning. And for anyone who wants to help, it's the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust. I wish you both the very best.